This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on November 18th, 2010. Should you have questions after listening to the recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
The open session for Thursday, November 4th, 2010 will now come to order. First item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes for November 4th, 2010. Vice Chair, understand we have a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of agenda document number 10-72, the minutes of our meeting of November 4th, 2010.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion passes 6-0. In terms of how we're going to proceed with the agenda, I think we're going to try to restructure it kind of along the lines of the movie Memento. We're going to start at the very beginning and work our way backwards, and then we'll get to the first advisory opinion that is on the agenda. So we're going to start with Obama for America, then the Brian Baird AO, then the San Diego Republican Party, and then we'll finish with the CTIA. I hope that doesn't impose any hardships, but considering that we're going to have a draft that's going to be circulating shortly, and with respect to CTIA, we wanted to give the Requesters Council an adequate opportunity to look over any additional changes. So, having said that, let's turn next to Draft Advisory Opinion 2010-27, Obama for America and Biden for President. Counsel for Requester are making an appearance, Judy Corley.
And John Burkhan.
And we have a presentation from the Office of General Counsel by Allison Steinle. And when you're ready, please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners. The draft advisory opinion before you today responds to a request from Obama for America and Biden for President. The request asks three questions. First, may Obama for America transfer $138,000 to Biden for President to cover Biden for President's anticipated net debts? Second, in the alternative, may Obama for America directly pay the debts incurred by Biden for President? And third, will the Commission toll the running of Biden for President's 30-day deadline to make payments to the U.S. Treasury that will be required as a result of the Commission's mandatory audit of Biden for President? The draft concludes that Obama for America may transfer funds to Biden for President to cover Biden for President's anticipated net debts so long as the transferred funds consist only of general election funds and do not include contributions made in violation of the Act. Accordingly, the draft concludes that the Commission need not answer the alternative question posed in the second question. The third question is moot because the Commission has not yet issued Biden for President's audit report, and the 30-day period to make the payments will not end before this advisory opinion is issued. Finally, we'd like to note one correction to the draft. The last line of footnote 3 on page 6 should read, and the candidate has net debts outstanding, not, and the candidate has no debts outstanding. The Commission has received no comments on the request or the draft, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have at this time.
Thank you very much for that presentation. Any discussion or questions of counsel? Doesn't look like anybody's jumping to the microphone all at once. Do we have a motion? Vice Chair?
If I might just take one moment.
Absolutely.
Sorry, I was still making the footnote. I think that this draft adequately addresses the issue. Frankly, I was concerned about the aggregation issue. I think that is raised by this. I know that we have a prior advisory opinion about that, which said that aggregation wouldn't be required in this context. But I think that it's not. I think it's an issue that is not clearly addressed by that prior AO and the regulation. So I think that is an issue. I think that based on that prior AO, this is an adequate result. I think it's not the only result, I think, that would be possible in this situation. So I just wanted to make that note. I don't know if there's any other comments, but then I'm happy to make a motion then.
Any further discussion? If not, Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of the draft in Advisory Opinion 2010-27.
All right. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion passes 6-0. Thank you very much. Turn next to discussion of draft advisory opinion 2010-26, Brian Baird. We'll have a presentation from Joshua Bloom and Amy Rothstein of the Office of General Counsel. Good morning, Mr. Bloom. When you're ready, please.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Agenda document number 1069 is a draft response to a request for an advisory opinion from Congressman Brian Baird. Congressman Baird will be retiring from office at the end of the current congressional term and asks whether the Act and Commission regulations allow him to use campaign funds to pay the cost of temporarily storing household items in connection with his and his family's planned move back to his home state. Based on the information provided, the draft concludes that the Congressman's payment of the temporary storage costs with campaign funds would not involve prohibited personal use because they are ordinary and necessary expenses in connection with the Congressman's duties as a federal office holder. We receive no comments on the draft. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that presentation. Any questions of counsel or any discussion on this advisory opinion request? Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move to approve the draft and advisory opinion 2010-26.
Any discussion on the motion? If none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion passes 6-0. Thank you very much, Mr. Bloom. We'll turn next to draft advisory opinion 2010-24. The Republican Party of San Diego County. I understand that that council or that there will be someone who will be calling in from the party. Do we know whether or not they're available, or do we need to take a moment to contact them?
Mr. Chairman, we're going to try and contact her now.
Okay. Why don't we take just a brief recess while you're contacting them, and once that's established, then we'll
thank you.
Come back into session.
Start.
This is April Bowling. Hello.
Ms. Bowling.
Yes.
This is Sean Worth. I'm calling from the Federal Election Commission.
Yes.
Okay, could you please hold on? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. I guess we're ready. Our open meeting is now back in order, and we will turn to our discussion of draft advisory opinion 2010-24. We have another presentation from Joshua Bloom from the Office of General Counsel. We have with us on the phone April Bowling, who's treasurer of the San Diego County Republican Party. And is Ms. Bowling, can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Bloom, when you're ready, please begin.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Agenda document number 1071 contains four alternative draft responses, drafts A, B, C, and D, to a request for an advisory opinion from the Republican Party of San Diego County. The committee has hired an employee to serve as its voter registration coordinator. This individual recruits, trains, and supervises contractors hired by the committee to implement its voter registration program. The committee asks a series of four questions, the first of which is whether the activities of the employee are voter registration activity and therefore type 1 federal election activity. With respect to this question, all four drafts conclude that at least some of the employee's activities qualify as FEA. They differ, however, over whether the activities so qualifying are type 1 or type 4 FEA, over whether the employee must be paid for those activities solely with federal funds or may be paid with an allocated mixture of federal and levy funds, and over the period of time during which any payment restrictions apply. With respect to the other questions presented, the drafts differ over whether the executive director's supervision of the employee is also FEA, and over whether the committee may amend its reports to allocate some salary payments between federal and non-federal funds. In response to the final question, all four drafts conclude that these responses would not change under the new FEA rules. We received one comment on the drafts. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Any questions of counsel, questions of Ms. Bowling, or any discussion on this request? Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll try to keep this tight.
I really don't have any questions for the requester, but thank you for being available, because it's not really, to me, a factual issue. But what this request, at least for me, illustrates is that what's FEA and what's not FEA is a complicated subject, even when the facts are clear. Going in no particular order, I found the comment helpful in that it made me realize that there's many ways to read the law. I'm not sure it reaches the correct result, but I'm not sure it reaches the incorrect result. But it certainly is one way to skin the cat that reaches a completely different result than any of the current drafts reach. The problem that I have with this issue in this request is the intersection of the federal election activity requirement that it should be paid for with all hard money, and the so-called Levin Amendment, which allows for certain activity to be paid for with a mixture. There's four types of federal election activity, and some folks, I think, well, this is salary, so that's covered by Type 4, and there's a reg that interprets Type 4, and this is a pretty easy case when you go down that road, I suppose. But I don't think it's that easy, because I think in that case it reads out of the statute the Levin Amendment, because the Levin Amendment itself says if the activity is of the activity described in Type 1 or Type 2, then you can use a mixture. The Levin Amendment has certain limitations on it. None of those are tied to whether it's a salaried employee or a contractor or whatnot. There are limitations that preclude Levin funds from being used for Type 3, which is a federal public communications reference federal candidates that promote, attack, support, oppose them. But there is no such limitation with respect to salary. So for me, the Levin Amendment has some application here. There is a reg that tries to, I guess you can read the reg to say the Levin Amendment doesn't apply, but a reg really can't rewrite the statute. The point the comment makes regarding Emily's list, I think, is a wise caution that when the commission gets off of the actual statutory language, we need to be cautious, because that hasn't ended well before. The flip side is when you disregard a reg, that doesn't end well either. Others can cite case law for that proposition as well. So this, to me, is a very tough one, because it really is the kind of question that I don't think the commission has had to confront before, because it's really a factual situation that the broad gloss of the statute and the regs really don't necessarily contemplate. But here we are, so we have to deal with it. But for me, I see this as an activity that's described in Type 1. At least some of the activity that this employee is conducting is Type 1 FEA, meaning voter registration, not all of it, but the coordinator of the voter registration effort, some of it certainly is voter registration. So because that would certainly be FEA, but for the fact that, well, it's still FEA, but how you pay for it is, I think, governed by the Levin Amendment, not the Type 4 more broad. I read Type 1 as the more specific of the statute, not Type 4. I think Type 4 is more of a catch-all anti-circumvention type thing to capture what had been a practice of moving staff from campaigns after the primary to a party committee to pay them with some mixture of hard and soft, and to do what's essentially the bidding of one or two federal candidates. I think it was put in there to avoid that being just shifted down to the state parties. So to me, the action is more in the other types of FEA, and the Levin Amendment was sold to allow party programs to be paid for not entirely with hard money in certain circumstances. I think this is that sort of circumstance. So I can't support a draft that makes this all hard. With respect to the executive director, I think that's a much easier issue. I think there may be some disagreement on it, though, but to me, there does get to a point where you're not conducting voter registration simply because you're supervising those who do. Otherwise, it would seem that virtually every party, particularly the smaller the party, the more likely this is to occur, would federalize everything. That seems to be counter to much of the rhetoric that accompanied the passage of McCain-Feingold, particularly the fact that the Levin Amendment was necessary for the bill to even pass. And I guess larger parties can have multiple employees, but the smaller the party, majority, the less employees there are. And at a certain point, the ED, I think, is the executive director, is just that, and that's not something that's going to be considered federal election activity unless the executive director is only doing, you know, federal candidate activity. Then that's a different case. I don't think that's the case here. At some point, this issue will come up again and again and again, and I think the commission is getting closer to it. Just the evolution of how things happen is coming up more in audits, not this particular issue, but the FEA issue, and it's something I think we're going to confront in the future. There hasn't been a lot in the past. Some have criticized this one reg that I've mentioned because the reg seems to even rewrite Type 4. Type 4 says activities in connection with a federal election. You know, most case law construes the in connection with the federal election when that's accompanied by the word expenditure. So I think the Congress intended to get beyond that distinction, but then the reg still says federal election activity or activities in connection with a federal election. So the reg seems to make them two different things. That doesn't make any sense because it would seem that one would be a subset of the other, but maybe not. Maybe they are two different things. But if you are going to look at Type 4 and incorporate the federal election activity, I think coming, if you're going to take that and essentially incorporate Type 1 into Type 4, you have to bring the Levin Amendment with it, and still means that you have to allow the party to use Levin funds. This party may not have Levin funds. This all may be an academic discussion, but I appreciate the time to state my piece as to where I am on this, because I think going forward it may help someone somewhere work through the thicket of federal election activity. Because ultimately I think what folks will do, and I think what they have done, is they think through how tough it is to do this, do things without doing it with all hard money, and they simply throw their hands in the air and just say, I guess we'll pay people with all hard, thus avoiding the issue. Someday someone will not avoid the issue, and they'll test it, they will sort of go back to the beginning. The comment cites an AO from 2003 for a proposition that really I don't think the AO stands for, but I can see how they're reading it that way. The AO is interesting in that the commission said benefits are part of the salary for purposes of Type 4 FEA, which may seem rather easy until you think through the idea that you have to pay benefits at the beginning of the month before the employee does time, and then I guess at the end of the month, if they cross over this 25% threshold, you have to redo the employment benefits. This becomes so cumbersome that I can see folks would just throw their hands in the air and say, well, I guess we're going to use all hard money. But that practical result does away with the Levin Amendment and the other limitations that were crafted in the statute. And at some point, this will come back to haunt, I think, the commission. But today's not that day, and I appreciate the time, Mr. Chairman, to state my piece.
Further questions or discussion? I agree with Commissioner McGann that the interaction of Levin funds with Type 4 FEA, how does that work, and how does Type 1 and 2 interact with Type 4? And after we've had many discussions, discussed this with my own staff, having looked at this many times, it isn't an easy issue. This one's been a very difficult one for me to determine how to land. The draft that I ultimately support is draft A, which does say that the voter registration coordinator will, by the representations of the party itself, more than 25% of her time is spent on activities that would be considered FEA, and for that reason, I'm landing on this draft, which says that must be paid, that her salary then must be paid out of the federal account. I agree with Commissioner McGann, though, that the executive director should that the answer on that question is that the activities of that director do not constitute voter registration activity. At some point, you start running these things up the food chain high enough that I just don't think that, you know, general supervisory activities are enough to trigger activities that are considered FEA. So, again, this I agree with much of what Commissioner McGann said. This is an issue that I think is going to come back, and we're going to have to continue to grapple with this one in the future. It's not an easy question, but the draft that ultimately I will be willing to support is draft A. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I support draft B. I think there is, in some ways, this actually is not that, this isn't going to be a long-standing precedent since we're interpreting a regulation that's going to expire in about 2 weeks. But some of the issues will have enduring vitality even under the broader regulation that we recently adopted interpreting FEA. Now, you know, the statute and the rule itself say that you have to pay somebody with entirely federal funds even if they do only 25% federal work. So clearly the statute and the reg contemplate that people could be doing a substantial amount of non-federal work and still they would have to be paid with federal funds. For me, it's not a hard call that the individual who's doing this, the employee, as we term it in our draft, is doing far more than 25%. And while we seem to have some disagreements about how much above the 25% threshold this employee has gotten in her duties, it seems, I think, that we have general agreement that whatever she is doing, it's more than 25%. Some of us think it's substantially more. Some of us think it's a little bit more. But I think we have general agreement that it is more. So she does have to be paid with federal funds. I also think the supervisor has to be, the executive director has to be paid with federal funds. I'm less sanguine that we will have an agreement on that. But, you know, I guess answering half a question is better than answering none.
Thank you. Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, for many of the reasons that Commissioner Weintraub just mentioned, I also support Draft B. I would note that obviously we don't have the details of the executive director's activities, but to the extent that it is related to the supervising, I don't believe we do. So that will depend entirely upon what the supervisor is doing. Otherwise, if it is not over more than 25% related to other federal activities, including this voter registration activity, then obviously it could be paid with non-federal money.
Commissioner McGann.
If I can, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask you a question to sort of get a sense of the scope of what we're doing here. I understand your analysis, and I think it's certainly a sound analysis. I think, you know, I think mine works too, and I think it's just one of these things where you can read the same thing and come out differently. But how I hear it, because this director, not the executive director, but the coordinator of the party program, is an employee, that seems to be the critical fact. What if the employee were not an employee but were a contractor? Would that change? Maybe the local party will know for the future. You know, is that the distinction?
From my perspective, I think that's a very critical distinction. I think that an employee. I mean, I think there is a difference between an employee and a contractor. I think the payments to a contractor. I think those would fall. I mean, let's assume that in this particular case, if this. That this person wasn't a salaried employee of the party, but was instead a contractor who was brought in to help out with their voter registration activities. In that case, I think the activities that they undertake that would be considered FEA would have to be paid for with a mix of federal money and levin. And then if they did other activities that did not implicate, that would not be considered activities in connection with the federal election, that could be paid for out of their non-federal account. So I do think that the distinction between an employee and a contractor is a very critical one in this case. And if this employee were a contractor instead of, again, being a salaried employee of the party, I think the analysis would be much different.
Thanks for that. Hopefully that may help those who listen to this who are trying to get guidance as to where the lines are, know where the issue is. It is odd, though, that, you know, the application of McCain-Feingold turns on whether one's an employee or not. But, you know, the statute itself does differentiate between employees and other people. And that certainly is based on you know, a reading of the statute. So I thank the chairman for that, and hopefully that certainly helps me. I hope it helps others.
Any further questions or discussion? Commissioner Weintraub.
To the extent we're providing guidance, I just you know, I'm glad the two of you are on the same page on that issue. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's a consensus on the commission on that point.
At this point, any further questions or comments? At this point, I would just inquire of my colleagues. It doesn't appear that there's four votes for any one draft. We could vote on particular drafts if anyone's so inclined, or we could. It looks like there may be some possibility of getting an answer on question one that might be that might garner majority support, and so. So we could either have votes on drafts, or we could instruct council to craft an advisory opinion draft that could be circulated on tally, that would attempt to kind of convey where we have potential agreement and where we don't. I'll, Commissioner Walter.
I think maybe the vice chair was going to cover what I was going to suggest.
Okay. Vice Chair?
I think that it does appear that there is overlap as to question one, and I think that would obviously be a good step. I think initially there's some interest in having a vote on one of the drafts, so I'd like to make a motion if that's appropriate at this time.
Commissioner Hunter.
Thank you. Just before we vote, I intend to vote for draft A as well, and I agree with everything my colleague, the chairman, said, and with much of what my colleague, Commissioner McGinn, said. It has been an interesting discussion that we've had amongst ourselves, and I wanted to also agree that there is a distinction if the employee is an employee or if there is a contracting situation. As we know, most state parties do a lot of they contract out a lot of this type of work, you know, usually pretty close to the election date. Thank you.
Commissioner Walter.
I'll just join the comments of Commissioner Weintraub and the Vice Chair. I would support Draft B. If there were consensus, I'd just say I'd probably support Draft C as well. But there is some reference here to the fact that in our E&J in 2006, we said that GOTV, which is known as Type 2 FEA, if a state committee hires a consultant a month prior to the election to design a GOTV program for a state party committee and recruit volunteers to drive voters to the polls on election day, the consultant's work would be considered Type 2 FEA. And I think that's something that I just wanted to point out as we go ahead. It's not really necessary to how we end up voting today, but so I'll support Draft B.
Okay.
But
Commissioner McGann.
But that's not for voter reg. That's GOTV, right? We're talking about voter reg today, right?
Okay. Okay. Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move the draft B in advisory opinion 2010-24.
Okay. Any discussion on the motion? If none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say no. No. Appears the motion fails on a vote of 3-3 with Commissioners Walther, Weintraub, and the Vice Chair in favor, and Commissioners McGann, Hunter, and myself opposed. At this point, then, I'd like to instruct Council to craft a draft that reflects the majority, where the majority may have an answer on question one. There would be no answer on question two, and then circulate that on maybe 24-hour tally. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I believe there's also consensus as to question four, which is whether the answer would change under the new regulation. So obviously that would have to be crafted along with the answer that's available in one.
Yep, I think that's correct.
Mr. Chairman, I would...
Ms. Smith.
I would also note that the requester's 60-day period, which has been extended, is currently up on Monday the 22nd, which gives us a little bit of time to craft something and send it around if that works for the commissioners. I just want everyone to be aware of the timing.
Okay. I appreciate you making us aware of that.
I think she's suggesting that, you know, if it comes around on Monday and people have already left their Thanksgiving travel, that could be an issue. So maybe we can anticipate that.
Okay. I appreciate you making that bringing that to our attention, and we'll certainly be sensitive to that so that we can make sure that we can conclude this in a timely fashion. Okay. I guess we can now move to the next matter. Ms. Worth.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Bowling? I, guess she hung up.
No, I'm here.
Oh, you are there. Okay.
I'm sorry. You guys are kind of cutting in and out, so I couldn't tell if you were addressing me or not. Sorry.
That's okay. The commission has concluded the discussion on your advisory opinion request. So I'm going to hang up on you.
No offense. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bowling.
Thank you for making yourself available.
Bye.
We'll turn next to Draft Advisory Opinion 2010-23, CTIA. We have Caleb Burns on behalf of a requester here before us. And before we launch into our discussion, we have a number of late submitted documents. Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I move to suspend the rules on the timely submission of documents so that the Commission may consider agenda documents 10-67A, 10-67B, and 10-67C.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion passes 6-0. We have a presentation from Mr. Lutz from the Office of General Counsel, and when you're ready, please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning, Commissioners. Agenda documents 10-67, 67A, 67B, and 67C contain draft advisory opinions that respond to a request by CTIA, which is an incorporated nonprofit trade association representing the interests of the wireless communications industry. CTIA administers the industry's use of common short codes. These codes are 5 or 6-digit numbers that wireless phone users can utilize to engage in a variety of activities, including pledging donations to charities. CTIA proposes to issue codes for the purpose of processing campaign contributions. All drafts conclude that CTIA's proposal does not satisfy the time requirements of Section 432B of the Act. The drafts differ, however, on several issues. Whether CTIA must require corporations to segregate political contributions from corporate treasury funds, and whether the $10 per text limit satisfies the Act's $50 anonymous contribution limit, such that no further safeguards are required, and if not, whether CTIA's proposed certifications are sufficient safeguards. We received one comment on the request from Aristotle and another comment from Aristotle regarding 67A. Thank you, and I'm happy to address any questions you may have.
Thank you very much for that presentation. Questions of Mr. Burns or discussion amongst commissioners on this request? Commissioner McGann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple questions for Mr. Burns. Got a comment from Aristotle, I guess it was the second comment on this one, saying the commission ought to show some flexibility on the issue that I had trouble with last time, the timing of when the recipient committee gets the funds. And we had discussed it, and I probably shouldn't do this, but I'll give you a second bite at the apple. Hey, you got anything else for me on that one? Anything to help me be flexible?
I can't speak for the commenter, but I suspect what he was getting at was to the extent and he alluded to this in his comments, I believe, you know, the notion of making the connection aggregator an agent of the campaign to extend the time period. I believe he was getting at concepts like that to, you know, for everyone to pull their collective wisdom together to see if and my read on the commission from the last meeting was that there's interest in trying to make this work. It's how do we make it work?
Right. Okay.
I take former Commissioner Mason's comments to be of that ilk. But in terms of do we have another statute or regulation or advisory opinion to point to, the answer is no.
Okay. If your client evolves to the point where there may be another opportunity, I'm certainly willing to listen. So you take that back, I guess, and say reconfirm what you knew last week, just stating the obvious again, as you heard it loud and clear. Second question is we have a blue draft here that's trying to capture where there may be some consensus and. First, did you have a chance to read it? Second, what do you think? But really, third, to sort of focus the what do you think is more on what I think. some of this stuff is just, I've said this last time, it is not required. A lot of it is creatures of AOs where there were representations that they were going to have a separate account and that kind of thing. I think this draft is consistent with the with past AOs. I think it's a step away from them in a positive way, meaning adapting to changing circumstances. So for me, the challenge is do I buy into all these belts and suspenders, realizing that this is consistent with the past approach, and it does show that the commission is willing to confront new situations intelligently and try to come up with something that's consistent with the past but yet deals with the future, or is this stuff too much and it provides too much of a shackle to either your clients' anticipated growth or maybe future growth, particularly the idea of having a separate account. I mean, that's been a theme in a lot of AOs. This draft still cites the pipe fitters case. I mean, that's really PAC. I mean, you don't have to make a pseudo PAC within a commercial vendor. But some of these AOs seem to say you do. I don't really like that, but it is, to get an AO, it seems like you're going to have to do something like that. And then the other is you know, the various protections to make sure that it's not excessive contributions, foreign money, and the like, which probably adds to the cost, is not necessarily necessary. But the flip side is, if you do have illegal money come in and you haven't done it, you don't really have the defense is a lot easier if you've done all this sort of thing. So you get the protection of an AO. So the balance is there's the rule. And then there's what you need to do to have the protection of an AO. So I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on this draft, and particularly those two issues.
Right. Well, I have read the draft. I'll try and be brief here. I know I ate up probably more than my share of the commission's time 2 weeks ago. But I can be brief in the sense that, Commissioner McGann, I agree with everything you say, and that this draft still relies on extra statutory measures that are just not required by the FECA, perhaps were not even intended by Congress, and may contravene congressional intent. Those extra statutory measures were developed in advisory opinions from, you know, the bulk of the ones cited, I believe, were in the late 80s, early 90s, so 20 years ago. Technology has certainly changed. Campaigning has changed. This is a tool you've all read, I'm sure, of how, you know, encouraging younger voters to participate is a massive exercise and an important one to maintain, you know, our representative democracy. And this is how I don't communicate this way, but apparently folks a lot younger than I do. And so this is, we see this as a vital tool. And so ultimately the question, I think, for the commission is a policy judgment. I don't think you are legally required impose these additional burdens. Again, putting aside the timing point.
Let me kind of push it forward a little bit. If you get this, what's the downside of this draft as is, as far as being counter to all the goodness you're sharing with us? All right, we definitely agree. You know, this in a way gets back to the grassroots, smaller contributors, you know, younger voters. All for all that. That's great. That's what a lot of this is about. You know, people seem to communicate via text message nowadays, and they don't talk to each other, and why can't they contribute that way? So get all that, but this draft, what does this run counter to that?
You forgot to add in mom and apple pie. This draft's about that as well.
That'll be in a footnote.
What this draft does, I mean, and if our request didn't make it clear, you know, I'll restate it. The more burdens there are, the more difficulty our clients and their members will have to implement this. So, you know, draft A, which would be the one I'd support, there we've got one hurdle to overcome, the timing. I don't know what it would cost our clients to deal with that. I don't know if the cost, the business expense to do so might overcome any benefit from these $10 contributions, commercial benefit, that is. So the more of these requirements there are, the more difficult it's going to be for our clients to implement this. And so that's why I'm pressing on the point that fundamentally it seems to me that it's a policy judgment for all of you, in that the separate account not required by statute, the $50 anonymous contribution limit appears to contemplate this type of activity. And so fundamentally, I don't think you're required, you know, your old AOs might have been predicated on that, but the statute, Congress can't come back to you and say, ah, you were contravening congressional intent by approving, you know, draft A. Statute just simply doesn't require those things.
Further questions? Commissioner Weintraub.
Just a question on the congressional intent. I mean, you've suggested a couple of times that we might be contravening congressional intent. I'm not aware of Congress ever having spoken to this issue. Do you have anything to back that statement up?
The only thing I have to back that statement up is the fact that there is an anonymous contribution limit, and as we discussed 2 weeks ago, that anonymous contribution limit can be evaded in a whole host of ways.
But they clearly were not contemplating text
messaging.
Messaging.
No,
when they,
no, that's
enacted
right.
That. Okay.
Further questions? Vice Chair?
Or, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have any questions, but just to note where I am, the latest draft, which is I think just entitled draft, but is the agenda document C that came out this morning, is the draft that I support. And I think it's, I hear the concern about the business costs, and I think that is obviously something that we take in account. And I think that's, frankly, we've looked closely in the last 2 weeks and you see the difference between the last draft and this one, looking closely at what these certifications really can accomplish, how much is already in your proposal, and what is yet to be done. I think the point is this is a commercial venture, and so that will be up to you. It is not a political tool. It is a commercial venture. And so if the costs wind up to be too high, I think that would be unfortunate. But I also don't think that we should necessarily avoid setting in place things that might cost commercial vendors additional funds if in order to comply with the basic principles of the statute, which require contribution limits and information passed on about people who provide funds over the $50 amount in order in the $200 aggregation amount. So I think that while as I said at our last meeting, I think that we should promote in any way that we can these sort of technology innovations that do bring all of the goodness, as my colleague said, to the system. I think we can't ignore the fact that these are still commercial vendors, and we can't be swayed by the fact that it may require additional funds to the compromise of some of the basic principles of the statute and the regs. So I'll be supporting the latest draft, which is Agenda Document C.
Commissioner Hunter.
Along those lines, I'm trying to understand what requiring the separate accounts gets us with respect to trying to be faithful to the statute. And I suppose it somehow separates the money so that corporations don't accidentally give certain kinds of money to a company. But we all know that monies are, you know, not in separate drawers, it's all sort of on a ledger, and it doesn't technically work in the way it did in the past. So I'm just trying to understand the business aspect of it. It might cost you more money to have a separated fund, but do you see any benefit in doing that from a legal perspective?
No, none. I mean, in no other aspect of commerce is this physical separation required. Big banks, you know, it's not like my bank account at Citi is in my pot of money, is in one pot of money, and my neighbor's is in another pot of money. It sloshes around in one account, and they account for it with sophisticated accountants and accounting mechanisms to ensure that the right money goes to the right place. The notion of the fact that, well, if the money was derived from a corporation, it's somehow tainted, I just don't get it. I mean, money's fungible. Corporations don't use dollar bills with different colors on them that somehow will corrupt the political system. So I've been at a loss for a long time, and frankly, in talking to my colleagues.
Don't give us any ideas. Commissioner Weintraub's putting up her hand.
I, I've been speaking to a number of my colleagues about this particular point, and they all express frustration with our other clients who are vendors that this is just, no one can see the point to this. Because this is somewhat of an unorthodox procedure, I'd actually have a question about the draft that, which one is this, the draft C that just came through a half hour ago.
I would say that since you were given it on such short notice and maybe justifiably looking for clarification, yeah, wouldn't.
And it goes to Commissioner Hunter's point. Page 11 says, the commission has consistently required the use of at least one separate account to segregate its general treasury funds from contributions. Is the requirement here that the wireless service providers and the connection aggregators keep their own corporate funds in one account, but that all monies that are coming through through the text messaging process, be it a donation for Haiti or a political contribution, that those have to be segregated from the corporation's own accounts? Or is this a requirement that political monies must be in their own accounts, the Haiti money and other money can be in it has to be in a separate account? I just didn't think it just wasn't clear to me, and I commend the commission on this draft in the sense that it otherwise, you know, while I disagree with the outcome, it's actually otherwise relatively clear as to what the obligations would be.
Commissioner Weintraub,
I think this goes to a point that I was going to make before. I think that's, you know, it's true that corporate dollars aren't a different color, but I assume you would concede that you cannot take corporate dollars and make contributions with them, right? The law does say that, right?
That's right.
We don't have a disagreement on that part.
No.
So that's where all this comes from, is that it's all designed to prevent corporate money from ending up as a contribution.
Right.
So, you know, that I was really kind of struck when you said, you know, we can't figure out why you'd want to separate out the corporate money. Well, because it's illegal as a contribution. That's why it needs to be separated out. Now, I think that's an interesting question that you raise, and I'm not sure that we actually thought that through all that thoroughly when we did this draft. I mean, my own view would be the problem with putting it in the same money with the Haiti money is that Haiti can take corporate money, but political committees can't. And if the point is to segregate out corporate money from political money, at least federal political money, then you probably couldn't have it in the same account.
Just to clarify my statement, what I'm at a loss for is understanding. I completely agree. Obviously, corporate contributions cannot be made. But as a practical matter, when you have a pot of money with both corporate, you've got a $100 pot of money, there's $50 of corporate money, $50 of personal money, what difference does it make if the physical dollars that actually go to the candidate were those $50 of corporate money, as long as it's otherwise accounted for as contributions coming from individuals? I agree that you can't make corporate contributions, but as a practical matter, if as long as the appropriate amounts of money are going to the intended recipients, what's the harm?
The harm is that corporate money can't be contributions. You know, it's just a flat statutory prohibition, and I'm sure you have a lot of great accountants, but, you know, people make mistakes, and billing mistakes are made, and some people pay their bills late, or sometimes they run into a problem and they can't pay their bills, and, you know, my cell phone bill, I get mistakes on it all the time. So, you know, just let's all rely on the accountants to make sure that this will never, ever, ever happen, that no corporate money will ever end up as a contribution, because we know that no mistakes are ever made in billing by any of your clients. I'm sure they all try very hard to avoid it. But, I mean, that's why you need prophylactic measures, because people are human. And computer programs sometimes even make mistakes because they're programmed improperly. If you don't have the corporate money in the same account from which the contributions are being made, then there is no risk that corporate money will end up in the being used for a contribution.
Commissioner Walther.
Let me just say that I support the draft that the Vice Chair indicated she would also support, but I do so with some trepidation. It's the same thing that I had before, and that is, and for example, this particular thing, I think we're doing very close to a rulemaking on a brand new technological area where we have a limited amount of expertise among ourselves, no I think we mostly admit that anyway, on the impact of some of these technological advances. We want to try to be as current as we can and still safeguard our own responsibility to fulfill the intent of the statute, which was not passed at a time when people were texting or had Facebook or had all the Twittering and all the other stuff. I did send $10 on the Haiti thing. I thought that was pretty snazzy. And but I think, in fact, we ought to try to look at this more generically. And I know there was a suggestion recently that we maybe ought to have a kind of technological summit, and I think we ought to try and do that. The idea that it's difficult for a bank or a corporation to have two accounts, I think is pretty stark comment to make, because I suggest that most banks have more than one account. And they probably have an account for maybe a number of different divisions. Why? Because it's what they do with that particular money, and they account for it separately. Law firms have hundreds of thousands of dollars and more than that. They have trust accounts. And it's not anybody's money, but somebody else's. I see this as very much like a trust money. And that's what the statute, I think, implies. Corporate money and political money don't mix. And so I see it as a trust, a separate trust, to deal with that money. And it's not unusual for banks that have trust accounts to have more than one account. So it's not like it's all mixed and mushed together. And I think that's really what we're talking about. And especially technologically today, it's very easy to have two accounts, and maybe three or four, and still get the job done.
Commissioner McGann.
I think to go back to the sentence in the draft, you raise a good point. I don't think it was thought through. I think it's simply trying to say that the commission in the past and AOs has required some sort of separate accounts. Now, that begs the question, because what really is a separate account? Is it merely? I mean, accounts nowadays are ones and zeros, right? I mean, it's almost the holiday season. It's a Wonderful Life is going to be on every day. And we're going to see how banks were back then, and I guess banks used to have enough money to cover all their accounts, and if they didn't, there'd be a run on the bank, and then, well, angels would appear as we're jumping off the bridge or whatever, But nowadays, you go into a bank, it's not like the idea of like the vault, where they're going to take your money in a bag and put it in the vault, and your money's in one bag and the next guy's money's in another bag. That's just not how it is anymore. Now, certainly there's trust accounts and there's all kinds of accounting things banks do, but for purposes of a commercial vendor, money is, as I understand it, fungible, right? What some are talking about, corporate money can't go for contributions. That's true. But that's not what's happening here, right? I mean, your client's not making a contribution. They're providing service, right? Somebody else is making the contribution. It's passing through, and that's a different creature. And this is what I meant earlier about saying we're essentially trying to impose the PAC regime onto a commercial vendor and making some sort of segregated fund, when that's not the purpose of that's not driven by the contribution limits. That's just separating things in some sort of way, because somehow we're trying to keep money pure. But it's still an individual contribution, even if it goes into a commercial vendor's processes and then comes out. You can still trace, the individual gives a dollar and the committee receives a dollar. That's fine. Where the commission has struggled is contributor gives a dollar, there's a 10-cent processing fee, so the committee is sort of receiving $1.10. Who picks up that dime? That can't be corporate money. That has to be factored in. Or if the committee, somebody gives a dollar and the committee only gets 90 cents, what happens to that dime? That's where the commission has had to think about what this means. But as I understand what you're doing, it's basically dollar in, dollar out. It's not corporate money coming out. I mean, you're not surcharging or enhancing this dollar and giving the recipient $1.10, right?
Correct.
Okay. So the whole, obviously corporate money is banned from going into federal candidates. That states the obvious, but it really has not a whole lot to do with what is in front of us here. which is my reference to the pipe fitter case, you know, the Supreme Court has interpreted this prohibition to require a, quote, strict segregation between general treasury funds and political contributions. No kidding, in the PAC context, right? That doesn't really apply to your situation as I read it, right? So you do have some concerns with this draft, as I understand it. Final concern I have, maybe it's not a concern of others, but we're saying no, and this is all over, you know, how we say no and how much we're going to say no. But once you get to no, it's a no, and the rest is, to borrow the judicial term, dicta. And is it better as a larger policy matter for the commission to answer all these questions now, when it's still a no? Or is it answer these questions when the first question ends up being a yes, and then we reach these questions later? My concern is we might be taking forks in the road we might not need to take, depending on how other technology evolves or how your client may retool or evolve or whatnot. So I'm concerned about answering questions that we really don't have to reach, because my concern is the same concern I've had ultimately is I can't get past the timing of how long it takes for the recipient committee to get the money. All this other stuff, I don't really feel we need to get there yet. It's a much larger question on how to deal with AOs as a commissioner, but you know, I think I can support this draft if you're going to tell me all this stuff isn't that big a deal. But my instinct is that it is a big deal. And I'm hesitant to support the draft because I fear we're reaching questions that we may not need to necessarily reach here today. What's your thought on that?
I agree. These are a big deal. I mean, that's why I still support the draft A, because fundamentally these requirements are not going to put our client in a position to be able to put this technology to use. Certainly not immediately, and who knows if ever, depending upon whether or not their business judgment, this is a profit-making exercise. But in terms of whether or not there's value to answering these questions, I think the answer there is yes. Our client, if nothing more, would appreciate at least a roadmap in terms of what it is that would be required. To the extent Commissioner McGann, not to make more work for you, but to the extent you would like to submit a concurring opinion or whatever it's called, I've seen that done in the past. That would certainly be appreciated, because fundamentally I agree with you that the segregation of funds and the extra prophylactic measures beyond the certifications for the $50 anonymous contribution limit are not required, and I think are unduly burdensome and may ultimately sabotage this whole thing. But that said, in terms of the value, you're right. I mean, our technologies, our clients' technologies could change, and maybe some of these issues get mooted at that point. But at least for now, going into next year, they will know what it is that the commission would have otherwise agreed on, though we would reserve the right to come back and ask again.
The flip side, though, is if we don't have all this extra stuff in here, and it turns out that a foreign national slips through, or it turns out it's more than $50, you don't have the protection
right.
of the AO.
Right.
Right. So, you know, if you're representing a campaign, you'd probably be saying no way to all this stuff, but you're not. You're representing a corporate, a commercial actor, and sometimes they like the comfort, and that's what I'm struggling with. So what you're saying is you better to get an AO. You're probably going to need all these belts and suspenders, and I'm hearing you say, if that's how it is to get an AO, so be it. You can live with that. Now, enforcement context is a whole different game, because this stuff really is. If you don't get an AO and you just go out and do what you're going to do, comes around in the enforcement context, you still have the time problem. But the rest of the problems, I think, go away for enough of us. But then you're playing that game
with corporate clients.
With corporate clients, which is a different sort of thing, and that they're probably not going to walk the high wire, which then inhibits technology, inhibits small donors using this, inhibits young voters getting involved, being able to contribute in a way that is comfortable for them, right? So there's a balance here that I'm trying to balance. What I'm hearing you say is the balance is it's better to get an AO even if it has extra things that aren't necessarily required, because that actually is better for all the policy interests. When you balance the policy interests, the balance comes down in favor of something like this, this draft that we're talking about here, not a simple no and come back later. You'd rather have this now than
yes,
than come back later. Okay.
Yes.
I think as this discussion is not only today but last time, in fact, I have to congratulate you, Mr. Burns, on not once but twice inspiring a rather robust discussion amongst us. And I think it reflects the importance of the issue that's being presented. I mean, how a law that was nearly 40 years old and a regulatory structure that didn't contemplate this sort of technology, how that applies. And this isn't the only context. I mean, there are multiple other contexts outside federal election law where how does a kind of old and sometimes clunky legal and regulatory structure, how can you apply that to new and evolving technologies that weren't contemplated by the drafters of those regulations and laws? How do those apply in a way that doesn't strangle those technologies before they have an opportunity to thrive? And I think that our discussion here is we're really struggling to try to find out how do we, how can we make this this work? I think that that this most recent draft that circulated that we got to just shortly before your presentation, I think there's been an attempt since the last meeting to try to find it. Still, as Commissioner McGann said, it still is a no. But is there a way that we can it be a kinder, gentler no in terms of a way that a little more flexibility is built into the joints so that there is a little bit of room to thrive and to evolve. And I agree that we have what the statute requires. We have what these advisory opinion have said regarding segregated accounts, and those aren't necessarily in the statute. They may be inspired or grounded in the statute, but they're not necessarily in the statute. But there are a number of advisory opinions that have come down, and so figuring out the best way to thread this needle has been, in a way that we could find a majority of us to support it, has been a tricky exercise. So without long wind-up, I actually have a question that I wanted to ask. In your request, on page 6, you go through 5 items that you say would provide additional burdens that just would not be worth the cost. I mean, if you were required to comply with any one of those, then it just isn't worth it. The just as a factual matter, the segregation of accounts, you didn't put that on the list, and so the question I have is, well, I agree that there's nothing in the statute that requires that. I wanted to just get a sense, if you know factually, what sort of a burden that would be to have a separate kind of merchant account. As Commissioner McGann said, now that banking's a little bit of a different creature, it is all just ones and zeros. We don't have money back in the vault. To what extent does that provide a costly burden? And to the extent you know, from your client's perspective,
I can't quantify it. We approached this from the standpoint of, this is how my client and their members do business, and we just want to superimpose this process on current business practices. I just don't have I know it is an additional burden, additional cost. I don't have a sense as to whether or not there's an appetite to assume those costs. But if I can maybe clarify one of the points you were making, that list of 5 things, those aren't in any particular order. Our point was simply just to flag the fact that all of these burdens are issues. Those list of 5 additional thoughts were there in an effort really to get the juices flowing, and really what I see from draft C is on some level taking some of those concepts and incorporating that in here, yeah, and in particular dealing with the $50 contribution limit. You know, you all have there appears to be the fact that the subscribers' addresses, the fact that the amounts that they would text in political contributions, the fact that the subscriber's name, if it has a corp or something on it, the fact that that information is available, as we noted in the request, coming up, the information isn't sorted that way, and the accounts aren't developed with that information. You know, you can't just hit a button and say, okay, give me all the corporate accounts and let's keep them from processing text message contributions. So but our purpose was to at least give you all some thoughts on perhaps additional burdens that would get us to at least some guidelines here. And I think that's what you've done with draft C, and I think that's helpful, as I said to Commissioner McGann. But they are all burdens. I can't quantify all of them, and at the end, in the final analysis, they may not be able to comply with all those burdens. And so that's where draft C leaves us.
Further questions? If we could, let's take just a brief 5-minute recess. Our open meeting is now back in order. A little bit of a longer 5-minute break than maybe we anticipated, but I think we have a pathway on where we're going to go next. Commissioner McGann.
Thank you. I'd like to move the adoption of agenda document number 10-67-A, which we've been calling draft A. I don't think it has a chance of passing, but I think that may be. I'm doing it not to show disagreement, but instead provide guidance, as at least where some of us are. And I think it's easier than writing a concurrence. Maybe just attach it to the concurrence. So still may write one, but that at least is a more definite, at least as a vote you can point to. So I'd like to move that document, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
Any discussion on the motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. And those opposed?
No.
The motion fails on a vote of 3-3 with Commissioners McGann, Hunter, and myself in favor, and Commissioners Walther, Weintraub, and the Vice Chair opposed. Do we have a further motion? Vice Chair?
Mr. Chairman, I move approval of Agenda Document 10-67C, the Draft and Advisory Opinion 2010-23, and authorize Council's Office to make any technical and conforming changes.
Any discussion on the motion? All right. All those in favor say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion passes 6-0. Thank you, Mr. Burns, for not one, but two illuminating discussions, and who knows, we may see you again sometime soon. So, Mr. Palmer, are there any management and administrative matters that we need to discuss?
Mr. Chairman, there are none.
Meeting is adjourned.